From Uniontown to Lebanon, State College to Erie, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, radical environmentalists are deploying a lawfare strategy, filing lawsuits in an effort to prevent the development of Pennsylvania's energy resources. David Taylor is joined by Rebecca Euler and Stephen Bloom for a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion. And the arrogance of the judiciary is on full display at both the federal and state levels as activist judges and justices seek to impact public policy. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Two special elections were held in Pennsylvania this past week. One turned out as expected. The other resulted in a major upset. Democrat Dan Kochnar defeated Republican Charles Davis in a special election to fill the 35th District House seat in Allegheny County. The win in that heavily Democrat district restores the Democrats' one-seat majority in the lower chamber. But the story was far different in Lancaster County, where Democrat Andrew Malone appears to have defeated Republican County Commissioner Josh Parsons in a special election to fill the 36th District State Senate seat. The seat became open earlier this year when former Senator Ryan Aumet resigned to take a position with U.S. Senator Dave McCormick's office. Donald Trump carried the district with a 15% margin last year, but it appears Parsons has lost by less than 500 votes. Republicans still control the state Senate by a 27-23 vote margin. The seat will be up for election again next year. Posturing for the 2026 Republican nomination for governor is heating up. State Treasurer Stacey Garrity, who last year won re-election by garnering the largest number of votes ever in a statewide race in Pennsylvania, told the Delaware Valley Journal recently that running for governor is, quote, something I'm interested in. Also popping up around the state is Congressman Dan Muser, who has expressed interest in running. State Senator Doug Mastriano, who lost the last gubernatorial contest to now Governor Josh Shapiro, has also hinted at a possible run. Democrats, of course, will nominate Shapiro for a second term. An interesting friendship has developed between Pennsylvania's two United States senators. Democrat John Fetterman will be joining Republican David McCormick in an event in downtown Pittsburgh to discuss a new book written by McCormick and his wife, Dina. They will be discussing how officials with vastly different views and from opposing political parties can come together for a rational discussion. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Bucks County is ground zero in a legal battle being waged by radical environmentalists who are working hard to prevent the development of Pennsylvania's vast energy resources. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association for this Capitol Watch discussion. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capitol Watch All-Stars from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, President and CEO Rebecca Euler. Rebecca, thanks for being on the program.
Great to be back again, Dave. Thank you.
And my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to be with you.
It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
Well, something really momentous happened in the last few days. At long last, justice has been served that in North Dakota, a jury has convicted the environmental group Greenpeace of incitement to criminal activity and defamation in the months-long standoff at Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, where the radical Greens were trying to block the Dakota Access Pipeline. And while the Greens are all screeching about how, oh, this is endangering everyone's right to free speech and peaceful protest, that most definitely is not the case. Again, that there was incitement to criminal trespass, to destruction of private property, and defamation of the company. The jury handed down a penalty of $660 million against Greenpeace International, Greenpeace USA, and the Greenpeace Foundation. It may bankrupt environmental groups in the country. And again, deservedly so, because for anybody who remembers back in those days, it was truly atrocious what was allowed to happen, what was brought on there. And in fact, the ultimate irony is that, of course, in the winter in North Dakota, everything is frozen solid. When the spring thaw comes, it's a mud plain, and that the green protesters left behind tons and tons and tons of trash, encampments, abandoned vehicles that the state of North Dakota had to go in and clean all of that up so that refuse didn't seep into the mud and contaminate the groundwater. So after we've seen so many extreme things happen over time with no one ever held to account. Of course, we see it now today, the latest iteration of the vandalization of Tesla Motors, mm-hmm. Their dealerships, people's vehicles on the street. To see one of these radical entities finally brought to justice for the harm that they caused is really quite striking.
We're all for free speech, and we're all for the right to protest. That is something we all
to peacefully protest.
Peacefully protest. Folks on all sides of the ideological spectrum should agree with that and do agree with that. But when it crosses over into inciting violence, that opens a whole different door of fearful consequences, many of which have directly hurt citizens of the United States because they were deprived the opportunity to have affordable, clean energy at their homes or businesses because of the ramifications of what we saw done where companies who tried to invest in these technologies were shut down essentially by mob action.
I think you mentioned the Tesla cases recently, and in that case, the case is being made that actually goes a step further into domestic terrorism, where you actually have the protesters are going a step further and trying to plan a concerted effort of affecting U.S. policy and affecting decisions that are made by the U.S. government, which goes, further than just trying to impact a company or impact the property of a company.
There was even a book that one of these radicals wrote about how to blow up pipelines. Whatever one's opinion is about what energy sources are preferable and which ones are not preferable, nobody has the right to commit that kind of terroristic damage that would cause mass destruction by blowing up a pipeline. This kind of behavior has been tolerated for far too long. It's gotten extremely dangerous. The fact that the Biden administration refused to defend the Supreme Court justices when there were mobs and protests outside the homes of the justices, when it's clear in the law that any attempt to intimidate or harass a jurist for the purpose of changing that jurist's opinions, like that is patently illegal. So anyway, at least in this one instance, it's nice to see that the rule of law at long last has finally been put on these radicals.
And hopefully we'll see some prosecutions too along those lines when we see damage really being done in the protest space. So,
well, there's a new sheriff in town. There's no question about that. And that sort of brings me to, what I see as a related point where, we've learned about the U.S. Agency for International Development and the way that was corrupted to direct taxpayer dollars, which were supposed to be for humanitarian aid, to instead direct that to left-wing pressure groups for the purpose of accelerating one particular public policy worldview. And of course, that's not what those dollars are for. That's not what the purpose of U.S. taxpayer-funded aid was ever supposed to be. And when you see this vast network of, again, uniformly left-wing pressure groups that were funded by taxpayer dollars, these groups are now cut off. And so it makes me wonder, what will our national discourse be like? What will the conversation be like if these fanatics no longer have an artificial life that was sustained through the back door by taxpayer dollars? You see the same thing happening with the Environmental Protection Agency, with the administrator Lee Zeldin, that in the dying days of the Biden administration, that EPA was just pushing billions and billions of dollars out the door to left-wing pressure groups. There was $2 billion for a group headed by Stacey Abrams of Georgia that only had like $100 in its bank account and had only been in existence for 6 months. I mean, crazy stuff like that. So now, the banks have frozen payments, that there's clawback. And I just wonder, what will a rebalanced public discussion look like when all of these radical groups no longer have this this unfair advantage?
And the word that keeps popping into my head is accountability, because for far too long the federal government has been operating in a situation where there is not the level of accountability that voters deserve.
Exactly.
And it's not even necessarily a partisan issue. We've seen over the years that government generally has just grown beyond the boundaries of what most citizens find acceptable. And so the idea that we can actually bring the government to account, and those who have been in some way artificially enriched because of government favoritism, mm-hmm. can be leveled, and that we don't have that situation that's so demoralizing to a nation, really, when you see the vast resources that the people who pay the taxes put into our government in the United States, state, local, and federal, and then what we expect in return is accountability. And instead, we've gotten decades of inaccountability, of free spending, favoritism, special projects, things that are off the record, things that we can't get the access to the data on, that the right to know requests are incomplete. We've seen so much of that over the years. So to be able to change that makes the economy more efficient. Everyone will actually be better off because there's accountability. And so it should be really a nonpartisan issue. Accountability is definitely here and definitely necessary.
Yeah, and I think it goes to the point that the only way that you get honest government is with limited government. Because when government is too big and has too much money and has too much impact on our everyday lives as citizens, well, of course everybody's going to have to be engaged in politics, and it just sort of drives that turbine of statism and more power, more money, more control over our everyday lives. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Steve Bloom from Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca.
Yeah, I would agree that accountability is really a big thing that we're finding out now has not been a big priority. But I would also add prioritization, because I think that now we're understanding what a lot of this money has been spent on and what the priority has been of the Biden administration for spending this money. And I think about it in practical terms. So, for instance, the infrastructure money that was pushed out during the Biden administration, a lot of that was focused on environmental projects. So electric charging stations or projects that were focused in environmental justice areas. And here in Pennsylvania, as everyone knows, we have infrastructure issues.
Right.
Our roads need work. And I know we were lucky enough to get a grant from the federal government for the South Bridge here in Harrisburg, which is a bridge on I-83. It's a $1.2 billion project. We got $500 million from the federal government, which is a lot of money. It's the biggest grant we ever got for an infrastructure project from the federal government. But when we're talking about a $1 billion project, essentially, and I see some of these numbers in these reports, and you talked about $2 billion for one particular nonprofit organization. Some of these numbers are, you know, $20 billion for this pet project or that pet project. And I look at our roads and bridges and I think, my gosh, you know, this is money that, where are the priorities?
Yeah.
This money could have been used to rebuild real infrastructure here in our Commonwealth. And elsewhere around the country. Where are our priorities?
Yeah. How should our lives have been over time, over the past decades, if those dollars that are taken from us in our taxes were actually spent responsibly on the things that they were supposed to be spent on? Of course, we're now, at the cusp of reforms on, very politically sensitive things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. But the degree of corruption and waste that's been discovered there, if those monies can be redirected just to providing benefits to people, American citizens who have earned them by paying into the system, well, this could be transformative. Like, Steve, for the first time in my life, I think I might actually live to see a Social Security check.
These are programs that are almost 100 years old. They were started during for the most part, during the Great Depression in the 1930s and extended throughout the remainder of the 20th century and into the 21st. But there's always been an element of uncertainty because for decades, those who watch these things closely have said it's insolvent.
Yes.
There isn't enough going to be there
with
the population trends and so forth to support a system that provides the benefits promised to older individuals.
Right. And it's supposed to go bankrupt in 2035, meaning that it can no longer pay full benefits. With the dollars coming in from the relevant taxes, but then you learn that there were millions of people on the Social Security rolls above the age of 120 years old. Well, I don't think anybody ever has lived to be 120 years old, and if so, in human history, it's only a handful, two or three or four. And so, the idea that there are 7 million Americans on Social Security who are beyond the age that anyone has ever lived in human history. It just like you're telling me that nobody ever went back and checked.
How do you make decisions about what your priorities are and how folks are accountable about these programs if you have no transparency? So at the very minimum, we're starting to get some transparency, and it's a good thing, but we're going to have to start making some tough decisions now that we have transparency about these programs.
Well, when Elon Musk and his squad of math geniuses were able to deploy algorithms to map out the spending chain, where the money actually went, where the money was hidden, who got it at the end of all these long and arcane processes. Like that was proof of concept that it can be done, and that information technology, machine learning, that we can actually wrap our brains around these immensely large and complicated government programs, where the people inside those agencies, that they have been very skilled at bureaucratic warfare and giving incomplete answers and stalling and hiding stuff. Well, the numbers, if you can get them, the numbers actually tell the story. And that is why we're now at this, what I think is a breakthrough point, where yes, transparency can be achieved because we now have the tools to show where the money went, to show because the data flow follows the flow of the cash. And if we can just stop the fraud and the misdirection of resources, the American people, quality of life for people is going to improve. I think this is also true with the U.S. Department of Education. The U.S. Department of Education does not educate even one American school child. The Defense Department has some schools that are international bases around the world, but the Education Department doesn't educate anybody. So if you dismantle the bureaucracy, if you eliminate the overhead, and if you take those dollars and then just block grant them to the states, there will be more money for actual schools, teachers, classrooms, and students.
Not only that, but the accountability is closer to the people.
Exactly.
Which is exactly what needs to happen. So
exactly. So, in a new era of accountability, I think I'm going to like this. I think this is just it's more honest. It's a better way to live. And I'm really excited to see what's happening.
And it's deploying the tools that we now have available that didn't exist in the past. You mentioned the algorithms and artificial intelligence, ways to analyze the activities that our government is involved in such a way as that it can actually tell the story, and whether that story is one of fraud and waste and abuse, or one of diligent care and making sure that hardworking taxpayers' funds are going to a place that actually helps the country move forward.
I want to live in that world, and it's good to see that day has finally dawned. So bringing us down to the final minutes of the program, thanks as always for being here and being part of that conversation. Thanks to the listeners for joining us. Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you do?
They can visit commonwealthfoundation.org.
Excellent. And Rebecca, where can people go to find out more about the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association?
They can find us at pmta.org.
Excellent. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. And from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks to all of you for listening. We will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. I have often spoken about the importance of the judicial branch of government. Never, except perhaps during the COVID pandemic, has the impact of the judiciary been more front and center than it is now. In the midst of an aggressive first 100 days in office, President Donald Trump has issued a flurry of executive orders designed to fulfill the promises he made on the campaign trail last year and which resulted in a sweeping electoral vote victory. Lacking majorities in either house of Congress, the left has turned to the judiciary in an effort to block or at least slow down implementation of the Trump agenda. They successfully throw up roadblocks by venue shopping. That is a tactic whereby the plaintiff scouts around to find an activist judge predisposed to rule in their favor. The most egregious example was Judge Juan Merchan, who presided over Trump's trial on bogus charges of, well, nobody knows exactly what the charges were, but he was nonetheless found guilty largely due to the highly questionable rulings of the judge. Now, the safety of American citizens is at risk because U.S. District Judge James Boasberg, an Obama appointee who sits on the ultra-left U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, is blocking the deportation of violent members of the El Salvador-based terrorist gang Tren de Aragua. Other federal judges have placed restraining orders or blocked everything from the firing of excess bureaucrats to the cutting of wasteful government spending. Exacerbating the problem is a single district judge's order can go into effect nationwide, not just in the district in which he or she serves. Thus, by venue shopping for a clearly biased jurist, the impact can grind to a halt the implementation of executive policy nationwide. The left has become violently obsessed with Elon Musk, screaming, literally, that he wasn't elected to anything but is wielding significant power. Well, the same can be said for the federal judiciary. They are an unelected branch of the government appointed by the president and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. The difference between federal judges and Musk is the president cannot fire a federal judge. All of this brings us to the core of the problem. The U.S. Constitution provides for three co-equal branches of government. The judiciary, however, holds itself above reproach. This arrogance of the judiciary also permeates at the state level, where judges and justices somehow think they are untouchable. Hence, you have John Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, saying it is improper to impeach a judge because you disagree with their ruling. Well, you can vote a president, U.S. senator, or congressman out of office if you disagree with the job they are doing. You cannot do that with the federal judiciary because they serve lifetime appointments. Thus, the only available avenue to toss a judge or justice is the impeachment process. The arrogance of the judiciary is manifested at the state level as well, where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has become populated by activist justices who are apparently aspiring lawmakers because they frequently legislate from the bench. They were active co-conspirators with former Governor Tom Wolf in trampling on our personal freedoms during the COVID-19 pandemic. They even went so far as to kick the state constitution to the curb and steal from the legislature the power to draw congressional district lines. Unlike the federal judiciary, however, appellate court judges and justices in Pennsylvania do not serve lifetime terms. They do serve excessively long tenure terms, but then must stand for a retention vote if they wish to continue on the bench. A retention vote is a simple yes, the jurist gets another 10 years, or no, he or she is immediately removed. In the history of retention elections, only one time has a state Supreme Court justice been denied retention. That came amid a massive scandal over the court's involvement in a middle-of-the-night pay grab that also resulted in a number of legislators being swept out of office. Due to other scandals, three seats on the state Supreme Court were up for election in 2015. With the backing of powerful special interests, three Democrat justices were elected. They now face a yes or no retention vote. Thus, Pennsylvania will once again become a national battleground with outside money expected to pour into the state. The three justices who may be retained this year will have an outsized impact on congressional redistricting in 2032. With an almost evenly divided Congress, they will be poised to have a significant impact on which party controls the U.S. House of Representatives. This is the only opportunity Pennsylvania voters will have to weigh in on the court. It is a decision that should not be taken lightly. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. The annual Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is set to get underway this coming Thursday through Saturday. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier gathering of conservative activists each year here in the Keystone State. This year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will be held April 3rd through 5th at the Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. Featured dinner speaker will be Kayleigh McEnany, who served as Donald Trump's first White House press secretary and currently is co-host of Outnumbered on the Fox News Channel. Additional speakers include John Gizzi of Newsmax, U.S. Senator Dave McCormick, Ned Ryan of American Majority, Steve Moore of the Heritage Foundation, nationally syndicated radio host Chris DeGaulle, and many, many more. The conference will feature speeches, panel presentations, workshops, and social events. Complete information and registration for the conservative event of the year, the 2025 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, can be found at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.